Hello, and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures Podcast, presented by NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with Shoshimworks, a global firm helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping society, industry, economy, and policy, and reframing how we build for resilient futures. Today, we're continuing our investigation into the ways that AI is informing ecosystems across industry and society, and exploring how we design pathways to resilient futures. I'm Diane Finkhausen, founder and CEO of Shoshimworks, and today I'm joined by my co-host, James Villarubia, White House Presidential Innovation Fellow and Digital Strategist for NASA's Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project. James, welcome.
Thanks, Diane. As Diane mentioned, I'm currently embedded with NASA, and before joining NASA, I worked in several social impact startups and the federal government, working on a wide variety of technology and policy-related problems and concerns. So our guest today and his sort of focus on technology and its use in law is really exciting. So back to you, Diane.
Excellent. Thanks, James. And we're super excited to welcome to the podcast today Richard Susskind, president for the Society of Computers and Law, and the world's most cited author on the future of legal services. Since 1998, Richard has been technology advisor to the Lord Chief Justice of England and Wales, and recently published his 10th book, The Future of the Professions. Welcome, Richard.
Thank you very much, Dan and James. It's great to be with you. Yes, I'm half a lawyer and half a technologist, and in the early 80s, I wrote my PhD at Oxford on the use of AI in the law, and went on later that decade to co-develop the world's first commercial AI system for lawyers. So I spent most of my life thinking in one way or another about AI. I had the great pleasure about a decade ago to start working with my son, Daniel, who's an economist, and together we extended the interest beyond law to look at the impact of AI across 8 different professions. So I am fascinated in the broadest of terms about the impact of AI in society.
That's great, Richard. I think I hope we get to all those various professions, because I think there's a lot there, particularly in sort of the most recent generation of AI. But I want to start maybe sort of towards the earlier side of your experience. I mean, you've been at the forefront of AI, particularly sort of how it impacts lawyers and the legal profession. Can you explain for our audience a little bit how it has evolved, how the legal profession has sort of evolved alongside the use of technology, particularly AI, over the many years, and sort of how it might impact, how we might see that impact today?
Sure. We first saw, I think, AI in the law, at least in academic form, in a paper in 1960. So that's the origins of the field in the 70s. There was a lot of theoretical work. But the practical work started in the 80s, and this is when I joined the fray, where we used what we call rule-based expert systems. And this was the first generation of AI, where what you did to build an AI system was you sat down with a human expert, you mined the jewels from their head, and tried in some way to model what you thought was their steps of reasoning in complex processes. It could have been medical diagnostic, it could be legal reasoning, it could be tax work. But the idea was essentially to build a huge decision tree, a massive flowchart. And in the system that I mentioned earlier that we co-developed in the late 80s, we had over 2 million paths through that system. And we showed, we think for the first time, that you can take a complex area of law and essentially reduce it to code. And once you have it codified in that way, you can allow less expert people to navigate through it. But then, as we know, that form of AI was displaced in the broadest of terms by machine learning. And that's come in two forms, in law as elsewhere. The first has been these systems that make predictions, and the most fascinating in many ways have been those that can predict the outcome of judicial decisions. This has been very controversial. But it turns out that using computational statistics, you can often make a better stab at anticipating what a court will do than using the conventional legal method. The interesting thing about these systems, of course, is they know nothing about the law. They don't search across the full text of judgments. They just have recorded a couple of 100,000 records of individual cases, who the judge was, who the lawyer was, who the law firm was, and on the basis of that, very large amounts of data make remarkable predictions. And people get very nervous about this, lawyers particularly. They say this is dangerous, it has to be stopped. It knows nothing about the law. But I often go back to the question that every client asks when he or she has a dispute coming over the horizon, and that's, what's our chances of winning? And so the question there is, what's the probability? The answer that the client's wanting is a probability. Remember Abraham Maslow, who once said, if you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Now, when a lawyer hears the question, what's our chances of winning, they think that's a request for the legal method. It's not. It's a request for a probability. And it seems to me that if we can use systems to deliver the answer to that question more cheaply, more conveniently, more swiftly, then the market is going to show no loyalty to the old ways of working. So we use these predictive systems not just for the outcome of cases, but also we can look through huge bodies of documents. And these systems can essentially predict those documents that an expert would isolate as the most relevant. And that uses usually a kind of supervised machine learning. But then came along, of course, almost exactly a year ago, ChatGPT and generative AI. I'd been following the GPTs for a few years, but the chat I found especially remarkable. I don't know if you're the same as me, but I find myself saying please and thank you when I'm using the system and vaguely apologizing when I ask it the same daft question again and again. But here we saw for the first time the idea that people with a legal problem might be able to sit down and essentially state their problem and ask for an answer. Now, I know these systems are not entirely accurate today. It's interesting in law that one researcher gave ChatGPT the multiple choice bar exam questions in the US. And first time around, it passed 2 out of the 7 papers. When it used GPT-4, it passed all 7. The question I keep on asking is, what's GPT-8 going to be like? Because we're already seeing remarkable performance. And in summary, therefore, I don't see AI as a simple, single technology. Generative AI is the latest chapter in an ongoing story of a set of accumulating technologies. But I think between the rule-based expert systems, the more patently predictive systems, as well as the generative systems, we're beginning to see a set of technologies that can help people who know nothing about the law, A, to understand their legal entitlements, and B, in fact, to go on to enforce them. Because in parallel, there's some interesting work going on in the whole idea of online courts. So that, in a nutshell, is the last 40 years of my life.
Just 40 years. You've hit on, I think, actually sort of really explained it well, sort of 3 stages of this technology, sort of there. So the human interviewer capture of experts, and then codification rule-based, sort of that machine learning where sort of actions and words sort of tried sort of more brute force. Okay, what is the predictive quality? And then finally, sort of this last piece of sort of generative AI, which is leaning a little bit more, I call sort of the creative elements of that machine learning. How do we sort of not just what the prediction would be historically, but what, you know, might we do in the future? But it seems to me there's sort of a, in that process, the human in the loop component of the law, or at least legal assessment, is sort of being removed. And we're sort of getting more towards sort of the expected sort of average outcome. It's like, oh, this, given all the prior work, this is what's happened. In the sort of that rule-based execution, I assume that sort of human interviewer was at least talking about what we intend, what we think is fair for the outcome to be, not just what the outcome has been. And how have you seen sort of that, the human influence on the AI systems change? Is it post hoc? Are people sort of evaluating, say, hey, here's what the AI thinks will happen, and here's how we pivot? Or is this being sort of, are humans being more removed from the process in the legal profession?
Well, there's a pragmatist and a purist way of looking at your question. The pragmatic view goes perhaps to Brazil, where there's a backlog in their court system of 80 million cases, or to India, where there's a backlog of 30 million cases, and says, with all the will in the world, these cases are never going to be resolved by human judges and human lawyers in the traditional way. So wouldn't it be better to have some kind of system, perhaps generative, perhaps predictive, that can offer some kind of binding determination for the parties, if not by a human being, then at least bringing some kind of closure? And we may need to rethink how it is that we value that and how we regard the importance of a human being empathizing and thinking through in a principled way how to respond to a legal problem. So the pragmatic response is, bluntly, this is better than nothing. And many people just want to resolve their dispute and get on with life. The purist approach, of course, says something very different. They say, well, it's not just about outcomes. It's, as you suggested, James, there's fair process involved here as well, that people have to feel satisfied that the system or the process is solid, that there's some dignity involved there, that it's treating individuals in a particular way. So there's arguments from both points of view. And in my past, when I taught legal philosophy, I was very much a purist, and I've said and did say in print, now slightly embarrassed by it, that this kind of technology was an affront to all manner of fundamental principles, and you need a human judge to sit in judgment. But the pragmatist in me, when I'm advising governments and judiciaries and policymakers, really does say that the access to justice problem is a global nightmare, that less than half the people in our world, according to the OECD, less than half have realistic access to lawyers and courts. Surely some kind of system that gives closure, even if not highly principled, will for most purposes be better than nothing.
Yes.
It's the same in medicine as well. And it has a deep regulatory issue here as well. Because many people, there is a red line that we shouldn't cross. Instinctively, many lawyers would say, if it's a fundamental removal of the rights of an individual, or if it's a fundamental issue of health, a human always has to be in the loop. But in billions of cases, literally, around the world in health and in law, there cannot be a human in the loop. There isn't a human available. So is the loop without a human, or the loopless system, better than no system at all? And these are the kinds of issues one needs to think through. You can say, by regulation, this kind of professional activity can only be done by human beings. But that seems to me, with my pragmatic hat on, often to be depriving people of some kind of enforcement of their entitlements, and in the case of medicine, better health.
Yeah, I mean, you sort of struck an interesting conundrum that we have to face, I think, is that the classic, was it Martin Luther King Jr., quote, justice delayed is justice denied. So, okay, what is the greater than injustice to either have no resolution in the court, or to have, you know, some resolution that is AI-driven and that you might distrust or not believe is fair? But that's an interesting consideration I hadn't encountered before. So thank you for sharing that. That'll be an earworm for a bit. Diane, sorry, you were saying.
Yeah, kind of along the same points. We were looking. We've spent a lot of time looking at the process of work and professional services. Richard, you mentioned earlier that you've looked at this across 8 professions. We spent a fair amount of time about a decade ago looking at how kind of platform capabilities, these types of AI and platform-enabled capabilities, could help us alleviate some of the pressure on high-value scarce resources. And very specifically, could we architect a marketplace approach to the access to and the management of legal services within a firm, so to speak? Because legal resources are inevitably high value, scarce resources, and a lot of the knowledge and the relationships are kind of tribal knowledge, right? So to the extent that you can tech enable those networks of insights, transactions, and connections, can you drive better outcomes? Can you, in fact, elevate the human experience within that system? And Richard, I know you've talked about using AI and these capabilities to deliver better outcomes, and how we can increase capable systems. How might we use system and system of systems design in order to, before these professions, in order to drive greater ecosystemic resilience? Can we design systems and interconnected systems to extend the reach of these knowledge banks and elevate human outcomes, to your point?
Many questions there. Let me start by clarifying the phrase that Dan and I use a lot, which we prefer in the broadest of terms to AI, which is increasingly capable systems. And we use that term in a sense to be agnostic to the enabling technologies. And there are a whole bundle of technologies that are in play just now. What fascinates us is basically these systems are doing more and often taking on tasks which historically we thought could only be undertaken by human beings. To answer the question about the professions, I always urge people to take a step back. One of my favorite stories in life is about Black and Decker, who manufacture power tools. And apparently when they recruit new executives, they take them off on a course, they sit them down in a room and they put up a slide of a gleaming power drill. And they say, this is what we sell, isn't it? And the new executives agree. They say, of course, that's what we sell. And the trainers with some satisfaction put up a different slide and they say, we don't actually sell power tools because that's not really what our customers want. And with a flourish, the new slide is essentially a photograph of a hole neatly drilled in a piece of wood. They say that's what our customers actually want. And it's your job to find ever more creative, imaginative, competitive ways of giving our customers what they want. And the great lesson here for all of us working is we tend to think that the future improved is a cheaper, lighter, quicker power drill. Not often enough do we take the step back and ask, what's the fundamental value we bring to those we help and serve? And might that value be brought in an entirely different way in an AI society? And so that leads me to an observation that very often when people are talking about AI and work in the professions, they're thinking about what I call automation, simply a computerized or systematized version of some of the tasks that human beings currently do. But I think that's a very limited way. Surely we should be using the power of the technology to allow us to do new and different things. So what might that look like? Well, in a way, you need to take the step back again and see, why do we have professions in the first place? And the professions, it turns out, Dan and I take 70 pages to answer that question to give you a flavor of how we go about it. But the professions, we say, are the solution in a print-based industrial society to the problem that we as human beings generally don't know enough. And when we don't know enough in critical aspects of our lives, our health, our wealth, our legal position, and so forth, the only way to solve our difficulty is to turn to a human expert. And these human experts have what we call practical expertise, knowledge, insight, experience, and textbook knowledge as well. And they essentially make that available to us in our particular circumstances. But when you think about it, if it's practical expertise is what of value, it's the challenge of the AI era is, can we meet that practical expertise available in a very different way? So going on, when people talk to lawyers about AI, they all answer, they ask the question, what does this mean for lawyers and judges and law firms? In medicine, when there's a breakthrough, people don't say, what does it mean for doctors? They say, what does it mean for patients? So the mindset we should be having, this is the system design, the design thinking mindset, our starting point should be the needs of society, of the community, rather than the starting points with a lot of professionals is, how do we systematize what we do? How do we computerize? And therefore, by implication, sustain and enhance and perpetuate the way we do it. Whereas what I'm suggesting is we need to take a step back and ask, what's the fundamental needs? And could these needs be met in a very different way? Now, this would allow us in so many important areas, health, education, finance, law, completely to rethink our systems. And if we're honest with ourselves, our health system, our justice system, our education system, our finance systems, by which I'm meaning in this context audit, are pretty much broken internationally. So we have an opportunity here, it seems to me, to rethink how we make the expertise available in these underlying disciplines. But it goes broader than that, because we begin to realize, Dan, I think this is really perhaps what you're hinting at, that the reason we chunk up knowledge in the way we've always done is kind of print-based industrial society, where knowledge and expertise were in humans' heads, we've had to divide fields of discourse into disciplines, law, medicine, so forth. But when people have problems in life, they're very rarely neatly labeled one particular discipline. So very often when people have got a debt problem in law, they've also got a health problem too, and they've got a social welfare issue as well. And one of my great hopes for AI is that it not only allows us differently to make human expertise available, but actually it allows us to swing practical expertise round to face the consumers and the community. And when problems arise, we'll have at our disposal the full set of insights and knowledge and expertise, rather than the rather siloed responses that we give today. And this is what fascinates me about AI. It's not simply systematizing and automating what we've done for decades, indeed centuries. It's the idea that it might break down some conventional boundaries. And in the context of ecosystem that you mentioned, we as human beings need access to knowledge and expertise. We will have access in a non-siloed way where all of this content actually faces us. It's not the purpose of law to keep attorneys in a living any more than it's the purpose of ill health to keep doctors in good employment. Problems have arisen to which the professions are our current solution. For me, the question is, how in the future will we solve the problems to which the professions are our current best answer?
I really like that. Sorry, go ahead, Diane.
No, just I'll turn it over to you here, James, but I think so right. So the limitations, to your point, Richard, of the way we have organized human knowledge, right, and the systems upon which industry and society have relied for so many decades is really those frameworks and mindsets are largely the result of kind of post-industrial revolution thinking and what the tools that were available to us at that time. Now in the digital era, the compute, the increasingly capable systems and the interconnectivity of all of these systems, it presents a world of challenge and opportunity. But the interdependency, right? So as we deploy a capability or an outcome in one arena, to your point, those boundaries are much more fluid or have been disappeared. So there are implications across a broader system, a broader network. So these technologies allow us, hopefully, to make sense of those downstream implications and the context of any given event within a system. So hopefully the mindsets, the methodologies, and the technologies, the capabilities will evolve in a way that drive more beneficial outcomes and help to empower the actors within these systems. Because it's a very complex kind of operating environment with this level of connectivity across healthcare systems, financial systems, right, legal systems. There's so much evolving that for humanity, it becomes a challenge to make sense and optimize within that complex.
Can I give you a practical example in the context, for example, of audit? So auditors are human beings who, in major companies, rock up once a year and look at a sample of financial transactions so that they can offer the market assurance that the published figures of a company correspond to the commercial reality. And all of us who are in AI are thinking, well, why would you only do this once a year? And why would you only look at a sample of financial transactions? Surely you could have systems running in background of the financial systems of an organization, raising flags, identifying anomalies, and so forth. So on the face of it, that whole discipline could be turned in its head and actually implemented through AI. But once you start thinking that, you say, well, why not fraud detection as well? Fraud's an entirely different discipline. But actually, if you've got systems doing this for audit, they could be doing it for fraud. Why not regulatory compliance too? And you begin to see that once you have this mechanism, which is in one way or another, AI bots roaming around the financial and other data of an organization, then so many of the issues which are fundamental to the resilience of society and the organization can be addressed in a different way. So it's repurposing the content and knowledge and making it available in a way that simply was not possible. And bluntly, maybe a decade wasn't even conceivable. And if I can tell another little story, my favorite story, in fact, I was invited to give a talk to 2,000 neurosurgeons in Boston, and they asked me to be controversial on answering the question, what's the future of neurosurgery? And my opening line was, and it's consistent with what I've said today, as I said, patients don't want neurosurgeons. Patients want health. I said, for a particular type of health problem, you're the best answer we've got today, and thank goodness for you. But I said, you know, thinking about 30 years' time, people will look back and say, it's amazing in 2023 how primitive they were, how they used to cut bodies open. Because I said, the future of healthcare surely is not simply robotic surgery. Surely it's non-invasive therapy and preventative medicine. And they agreed. Now, what I want to say to you is that the mindset of almost everyone who's working in AI in the world just now is robotic surgery. What they think is, and it's my automation task substitution, as economists would put a point, what people think, and it's an incredibly anthropocentric view, is that the real impact of AI is in doing the things that we do. Whereas for me, I'll say again, the joy of all of this is the equivalent of non-invasive therapy. How can we deliver the results, the outcomes that our communities and individuals want in entirely new ways that weren't possible without the technology. And insofar as our work is involved with solving problems, and much professional work is that, how can we put the fence at the top of the cliff rather than the ambulance at the bottom? Preventative medicine, preventative lawyering. How can we help avoid problems rather than resolve problems? That's the power of existing and emerging AI, not simply to computerize what we've done for the last 60 years. That's the story of technology in the professions. You essentially graft technology onto the old ways of working. What I'm seeing is something fundamentally different. And it's not just true of professions. It's true of absolutely everyone. Because back to the hole in the wall, what's the value bring? And might we bring this value in new ways with the advent of increasingly capable systems?
I really love that example. I was going to ask for one anyway, so I'm really glad you shared. And those are, I think, really illustrative. I guess my brain went to sort of back to the sort of idea of sort of the fundamental need of the user, right? It's not, we don't have lawyers for the sake of lawyers. We have lawyers to help deal with legal issues. I guess one of the things I am concerned about was sort of the last big tech boom, and really all the sort of technology booms throughout history, is sort of the speed with which we sort of run rampant through them on the assumption that speed is good. And I see this sort of conversation emerging right now around AI. But even if you go through history, I mean, I think the term Luddite, we always talk about it like, oh, they hate technology. And that's probably more an ahistorical PR smear. The winners of that argument got the right to history. But in reality, it was weaving and looms being sort of used to mechanize a whole industry within a couple of years. And there were no union protections for all of these people who were suddenly out of work. And so the question is, okay, well, like, could we have handled that situation socially better because it ended up in sort of armed revolt and burning down factories? Maybe not the best outcome. But I think, you know, even looking back to sort of the 90s, the issue with sort of a lot of the globalization that we had from the internet and the tech boom was not necessarily that it happened. Great, it's going to happen. But it happened so fast that it basically was too fast for society to adjust careers, adjust income, and sort of destabilized economic growth in other ways. It was a wealth transfer as much as it was a wealth growth. Are you seeing, the question I guess I want to ask is, are you seeing that sort of hesitance in a lot of these professions saying, okay, yes, we want to move forward, but we've got to at least deal with the reality that we can't retrain, like there, you know, might be 45-year-olds or 50-year-olds who have 15 to 20 more years of expected work. We can't retrain them overnight in whole new professions, particularly deep expertise professions like medicine. How are the professions that you're seeing dabbling in AI, how are they dealing with that sort of internally in their own, you know, certification or on their own boards? What's going on there?
Well, for a variety of reasons, most of the professions, and I find this understandable, but most of them are fairly conservative in the response to AI. We hear many stories, but they're the exception rather than the rule. And I always say of the very successful professional firms, the lawyers, the auditors, and the architects and so forth, it's hard to convince a room full of millionaires that they've got their business model wrong. The reality is they're very successful organizations, and when I come along and say there's a different way to conceptualize practical expertise, you can imagine how joy-filled they are. And for many people running these organizations, they think, and not, I think there's much merit in this, they say, I've only got 5 years to run as the leader. I think this problem and AI and an opportunity is for the next generation. It's not for me. So what most people are doing in the professions is saying, we get it, we see it, but it's probably 10 years away rather than 2 years away. I should also say that almost every profession thinks there's far greater scope for AI in all other professions other than their own. We all do this special pleading. We say, well, and we're rather different, of course. So you've got this response that it's going to take longer, which actually I agree with. I think the old thing that less happens in 2 years and think more happens in 10 years. I think that's true of AI. There's also the special pleading element. But I do think that there is recognition, and this has only really been through the past year because of how astonishingly demonstrable ChatGPT is. I've heard it said that every Fortune 1000 CEO and every prime minister around the world has seen a demo of ChatGPT. It's so much more powerful than many of the other AI systems that we as technologists know have been breakthroughs. And so it's pretty hard in any discipline, after spending a serious amount of time, even with the first version of ChatGPT, not to think at least some of the routine, repetitive process administrative work that occupies our junior professionals won't in some way be taken on by systems. So the conversation is already beginning, and I think it's reluctantly for the reasons I've mentioned, but it's beginning, I would say, with a focus on the 30s, 2030 and beyond. We're going to be very different in the professions. And I think it's healthy to be having that conversation just now. I keep on saying, I think it's manifestly important, but I don't think it's quite as urgent as some would suggest. I think a lot of the everyday impacts of AI, generative AI today, have actually been really more of the drudgery in the back office, as it were, like some kind of administrative assistant, rather than at the cutting edge, offering legal advice, offering diagnostic advice, generating building plans and so forth. I think we're some years away before the technology will be reliable. And so the impact so far, I stress, practical impact, but this is getting people excited, is that a lot of the grunt work that could actually perhaps be done rather differently. But I want to answer the bigger and broader issue. And as long as we're driven by markets, Dan and I are pretty confident in this point, that the thesis is broadly this, that our machines are becoming increasingly capable at an accelerating rate. They're taking on more and more tasks and jobs that historically we thought could only be undertaken by human beings. Now, many people say, well, aha, new jobs are arising. But we've seen no evidence to suggest that machines won't take on these new jobs as well. Prompt engineering is a good example. I know there's a frenzy about prompt engineering as a new discipline, and of course it's vital. But it seems to me, as the systems become more interactive and have better ways of actually interrogating you, the user, a lot of that prompt engineering will actually be built in the system itself. And so we find it hard to avoid the conclusion that over time, there'll be less and less need for flesh and blood professionals working in the way they always have done. And I think the impact on society of this is profound. I think we haven't thought this through at all. It may well be that this technology gives rise to far greater economic activity, a far larger pie, but a fascinating question of essentially political philosophy is how or whether we can redistribute the wealth that will be generated by a relatively small number of tech companies that own both the enabling techniques and technologies as well as the data itself. There's profound questions about technological unemployment. People laugh at Keynes and said he got it wrong. Yes, timing was wrong, but it seems to us entirely likely if you look, for example, at autonomous vehicles. And for me, in terms of a philosophical discussion, the timing doesn't matter so much. Whether it's 3 years or 23 years, I think we can all see the day when these vehicles will mean that many people will drive trucks and cars, and many industries and indeed towns and cities that have been built around the idea of transit with human beings will actually be redundant. And we've not begun to think what this means for employment. And in turn, I think there are challenges about what this means for a meaningful life. Now, we have to be very careful that people like ourselves who sit around chatting about how we get meaning from our work, we shouldn't generalize that, because there's many people who I'm afraid are very sad in their work and don't enjoy it, and it is drudgery and so forth. But I think the advent of these ever more capable systems that might take on some of the tasks that gave our lives meaning historically does really strike at the core of what it is to be a human being. And we're not really having these conversations. We're having some very interesting conversations, and I think they're also important, about the existential threats of AI. But there are some short and medium terms issues, social, economic, political, that the conversation so far has actually been quite preliminary.
Yeah, I think that is really fundamentally, Richard, that's the tension that we should be giving some thought to. And I know that so many of our conversations have really stepped from concepts like the future of work to the future of cities to the future of education. And ultimately, to your point, Richard, what we are faced with now is an opportunity to, if we look out a couple of decades, right, whatever that timing may be, what does it mean? What is the human experience? And what is our purpose? What is our identity? What is our relationship with society, with industry and technology? How does technology inform what the human experience will be and the meaning of life? To your point, can we rise above the task in order to embrace the pinnacle of the human experience, or does this just become a kind of an iterative progression of task automation, to your point? My hope for the future is that we can be very thoughtful about how we design the path forward and really create a harmony between these increasingly capable systems and what the human experience will be for humanity, industry, society. I'll turn it over to James, because I know we've had so many conversations along these lines. And I, for one, choose a more hopeful view of what these technologies, these capabilities can unlock, whereas we have to be intentional and thoughtful about the design from this path forward.
Yeah, I was really struck by your comment. It's just stuck in there as like a reference to the political systems that we are in. And I think that really strikes me as the real structure. I mean, you were talking about sort of your role in bridging AI and across all these professions and the legal professions, and myself as sort of a government bureaucrat, as it might be termed, and as well as a technologist, I'm seeing those sort of interactions of with sometimes frustration and sometimes excitement of like, oh, we could do this great thing, but we struggle organizationally or whatever it may be politically. So I do think that, to Diane's point, there is this question ahead of us. I think both of you sort of tied down. The pie will get bigger with AI, but we have not yet figured out if our political systems or organizational systems or economy will actually divide the pie more evenly, or will the pie, someone's piece get way bigger as the pie itself gets bigger. And that duality, I think everyone in the tech community says, yes, the pie is going to get bigger. That's awesome. But there's a tacit assumption that, oh, that'll be great for everyone. And I am not sure that's there yet. And I think we need to be cautious and thoughtful, to Diane's point. But it's interesting to see, Richard, I liked your comment of sort of a lot of boards or leaders right now saying, oh, that's the next guy's problem, which is not being thoughtful and is not being forward thinking. And I wonder how many organizations, how many professions are going to get caught more flat footed than others as this emerges over the next 3 to 23 years. So, well, great conversation. Yeah.
So, for example, in the legal world, there are now about 3,000 to 4,000 law tech startups, about 1,000 of whom are trying to do to law what Amazon did to book selling. And so many of the answers, I think, to the kinds of questions we've been discussing are going to come not from within the traditional professions. They're actually going to come from beyond. And so those economies that are encouraging and enabling a healthy body of startups are those that actually are likely to be prosperous too. Now, I know most of them will be gobbled up in due course by larger organizations, but my point is that the change is likely to come, and the ideas for change is likely to come often from beyond the ecosystem rather than within the ecosystem.
So how should we, if we kind of synthesize this down into maybe some practical advice for our listeners, Richard, how do we help them kind of navigate this exciting but challenging kind of landscape of increasing change in the systems that are supporting society, industry, and policy, right? So how can leaders kind of think about the actions, the decisions that they should be taking now in order to design for greater resilience? To your point, there can be surprises entering ecosystems from beyond. So how do we encourage them to be a little bit more resilient in the actions and decisions that they're undertaking today?
Well, in the broadest of terms, and you've mentioned a key element, the first thing is that leaders have to become engaged. This is no longer a technical issue that can be left to the technologists. In each and every organization, whether private sector or public sector, small or large, organizations will be defined by those leaders who can understand and implement technology. But I think there's also two mindsets that are important for thinking ahead. and each organization has to embrace both. The first is short-term, which is very much driven by where you are today. And you should ask yourself, what are we going to do in the coming year in relation to AI and all these remarkable developments? How should we respond? And that I call legacy-based thinking, where sometimes it says walking backwards into the future, but you're contained and constrained by where you are today and in practical terms, what you might achieve in a year. But also, and in parallel, we have to encourage leaders in all organizations, and most find it very difficult to engage in long-term thinking, what I call vision-based thinking. And 2030 is not a bad place to start. And ask within your sector, your industry, your market, your business, your organization, what is the future likely to look like? What is our world, our markets, our conditions likely to be in 2030? And you can use well-established methods of scenario planning and say there's no single future. Let's look at a possible scenario, let's look at a likely scenario, let's look at an outlier and so forth. But there's methods for doing this. And then I suggest a form of vision-based planning where when one's thought through these scenarios, you pretty much pitch your fork in one space to say that's where we're heading to. And the question then becomes, how do we get there from here? What does our roadmap look like? So I want organizations to have a roadmap to a likely 2030, as well as a practical plan of what to do in the coming year. But we need to disengage this short-term frenzy thinking that we've got just now about generative AI from the long-term strategic thinking about future impact. And I always like the quotation, it's not clear who said it. Someone said the best way to predict the future is to invent it. And I think that is so terribly important, because when we're doing scenario planning, if you're a big player, it's not so much what does the future look like, it's what future do we think we can help create. So it's partly a process of analysis, partly a process of extrapolation, partly recognition, I'm afraid, that probably by 2030, our worlds have been transformed by technologies that haven't yet been invented. But it's also partly taking on the responsibility yourselves to create and head for a particular vision. The key bit in all I'm saying here is, although I understand the short-term focus and frenzy, whether it be from regulators or other organizations on generative AI, this, I stress again, is just the latest chapter of a fascinating, very fast-moving, ongoing story. And the key is to try and think three or four chapters ahead and not just fixate on the current capabilities and restrictions.
In fact, what I'm hearing is we lean into generative HX, so the generative human experience, as we understand and deploy and learn from these increasingly capable systems, we can take on better and better decisions to craft the future that we want to be and the human experience that we want to live. And with that, we'll need to wrap it up from here. And Richard, this has been incredible. And we're so grateful for your perspective. James, any final thoughts from you as well before we wrap it up for the day?
I think the thing that's really stuck out to me has been the idea that you introduced, Richard, around sort of this AI crossing professions and how we connect, how we have an AI version of Diane, an AI version of Richard, and how the combination of those might be more powerful, might lead to outcomes and solutions that we had never considered because the industries had sort of grown up, the legacy of them had been pretty stovepiped. So yeah, that's gonna stick with me. So thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you. I've really enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks again, everyone, for joining us today. And please do check out the season's new episodes to join our discovery journey as we explore the AI arena, pressure testing hype versus reality, and understanding where practical applications of these capabilities are shaping ecosystemic futures. Follow us and subscribe on Apple Podcasts for your favorite place to access podcasts. And you can always learn more at shushumworks.com.